understands the actual functionalship, so then you can have a proxy for it.
Okay, I think we're all back. Welcome back to the second part of this morning session. And as suggested before, we'll continue a bit to talk about Mendelian randomization, some specific issues, try to elucidate where really it might have its place in identifying new targets and being helpful on the way from identification to phase three trials. Touch upon biomarkers in general, and in that context also try to elaborate a little bit on some studies, some new compounds we have not been talking about. We have talked in detail about CDP inhibition, but we'll talk a little bit also about anti-inflammatory therapy and also inhibition of phospholipases. So my first question would be, I mean, you very nicely showed us three different examples of Mendelian randomization, and you also alluded to the limitations, which obviously on one hand is the relatively small effect size that you do see in these studies, and on the other hand, power issues. Now, we have a number of examples of positive and negative Mendelian randomization studies, but what would be, how do we interpret that? I mean, if you're looking in small effects and we do see a positive outcome, then it reassures us that it's first causal and that intervening, if the target is druggable, we might see a positive effect. But in the case of negative studies, I mean, coming back to the small effects, taking into account that in many instances, if it comes to a drug intervention, you may see more pronounced effects. How do we interpret that? I mean, if is a negative study so negative, so to say, that we could that we should keep off that specific target? Or
I think it's difficult and comes back to the notion that we should be using the MR as a tool. I think the positive studies are great and are very helpful, but as you say, the negative studies pose more problems. I think if a study is designed appropriately and is powered appropriately, then coupling negative findings from a study like that with some biological knowledge, I think it's a case of prioritization. So it wouldn't be something that would be top of the list for being pursued as a target. It doesn't rule it out completely, because there may be something like the threshold effects that are very difficult to pursue with the MR technique. But it comes down to probabilities and likelihood that a potential target is going to be useful. So MR for prioritization perhaps is a better way of describing it.
So one of the things that sort of come up sort of quite recently in this area is sort of, and we have the genome-wide association studies, which often produce multiple signals, often very small. If we're lucky, you get a LOD score of about 2, and if you're very lucky, you get anything larger. And we have, increasingly, we have the ability through what's coming through from the technical perspective with, you know, total exome sequencing, we are going to have expression data, we're going to have the SNP cohorts done on very, very large panels. How do we get past the problems of actually defining pathways and looking at them? Because it seems that the strength of Mendelian randomization particularly is based on single targets, and that the statistics rapidly degrade as you begin to add subsequent things, even in that whole, even in the same pathway, because there's no guarantee that everything will go the same way. So, how do we actually approach that problem? Because in the general omic sense, that is one of our major issues at the moment. We have this huge surfeit of data, and it's all our statistics are mostly based on independent effect. And that is the crucial base of all the statistics that we use. We never use statistics that actually co-map things accurately, because no one can actually make up their minds on how to do things like factor analysis satisfactorily. and let alone to reproducible standards. I don't know what your views.
I think the new technologies are helping us identify which variants to pursue. We've got a better idea of the expression consequences of a variant or the changes in protein structure, protein function. Thinking about the pathways question, if we assume that variants are inherited independently of one another, then approaching them independently is still valid. Because if you take a SNP in a gene at the top of a pathway, and you take that as your modulating intervention in your MR study, then almost like a domino effect, you're going to influence the rest of that pathway downstream, which should be a consequence of that, but the inheritance of those variants should be independent of one another. But the biology is not independent.
Which is true if they're replicated on different chromosomes, but chromosomes effectively link things.
So that brings in another consideration when you're designing your MR study about linkage disequilibrium. So making sure that the variant you're using as your instrument is in fact what you think you're using. So you're not bringing in other variants that could confound the observations that you make, bringing in other bits of the same pathway that could go in opposite directions to your index variant. So if we think about it in terms of drug targets, your drug is going to target a single target molecule. It's unlikely to target a whole pathway, each step of that pathway. So choosing the variant carefully, making sure that it's independent of other things genetically, will allow you then to interpret its effects on downstream phenotypes more clearly.
So wouldn't you say that sort of just picking the targets, one of the ways that I would just suggest as thinking aloud really on the experiments is, if we come up with a target for Mendelian randomization and we haven't got a drug, what do you think one of the approaches should be? Because we have this sort of marvellous new technology that's coming around with antisense and antisense knockouts, which actually enable us to actually specifically knock down pathways. And in contrast to animal models where you actually can offer inherit a block of genes around the gene that you're inserting. So the knock-in and knock-out animals can actually confound you, and Jay Luce has done a lot of work on that area. Do you think that we actually ought to be sort of using sort of antisense technology in cell lines or in animals to actually validate some of these models? Do you think that's actually a reasonable approach?
I think as a follow-on step from the MR study, yes, or if not a preceding step to try and give yourself a biological prior hypothesis before you go into the MR study. I mean, the animal models are clearly fraught with problems, but help to inform the selection of your instrument, give you an idea of other members of that pathway. It's a big problem in MR studies, I think, this confounding within the genetic sphere, because that's where you're most prone to it.
Tabasom?
Yes, I forgot to tell you another limit that you didn't mention. In one of your first slides, you paralleled the development of a drug as phase one, phase two, and a randomization, as we know about in trials. And you paralleled that with a Mendelian randomization study. Mm-hmm. So the problem is, when you randomize the population, you try to homogenize the population in terms of factors. But in Mendelian study, you don't random anything, because even genetics is not necessarily a random variable, because you may have some population that for one reason has a higher frequency of variant alleles. So you're not dealing really with a randomization study. And this is a problem, because people may misunderstand what we are talking about when we talk about Mendelian randomization study. It's a little bit like when we do epidemiologic study, and I do it myself, and we do propensity score in order to try to limit the problems with not randomization. And so I'm a little bit puzzled about the name randomization study regarding Mendelian studies.
I agree that the terminology can often be unhelpful. The problem of different populations is one we have to be careful about, and I think the simplest way is to make sure that if you set out to do a study, you only include samples from populations whose ancestry you're certain about, so making sure that only individuals of Western European ancestry are included or people of African American ancestry are included, and you keep them separate, or you account for differences in allele frequency between those statistically, which is suboptimal but often done relatively successfully. The point about the randomization stage of the whole thing is, I think, it's difficult to understand because we're not actually doing anything to the population, and I think that's where people it comes unstuck in their understanding. Whereas with a drug trial, you take your sample and you randomize them one way or the other. The randomization here occurs on a cellular level at the time of generation of gametes and at the time of conception. So you have randomization into two haploid cells, and then a random pairing of haploid cells comes together to form the embryo. That's these two points of dichotomy that makes the randomization.
Yes, but what about all other variables which are confounders? I mean, you need to have them, and you don't have them in your studies. So this is a huge, huge problem, talking about randomization while there is no randomization at all.
With thinking about the other variables and the potential confounding, if we assume that genetic variants are inherited independently of one another, then the only... If you design your study right, then it's true. Then variables that are potentially confounding that aren't related to your genotype at your specified locus should be balanced between your two genotype groups. If those variables in the environment or in behavior have nothing to do with the gene that you're looking at, and the gene you're looking at has no relationship to genes that influence those variables, then you can discount them as balanced confounders in the same way we do with a randomized trial.
I'm sorry, I don't want to take all the discussion, but you do have some gene-environment interaction. You cannot say that there is a randomization while choosing the gene. It's just the word randomization which may be a little bit exaggerated. That's the only thing I wanted to add.
So really, just to develop that point, how big a problem do you think is that the underlying populations in this studies, because we're looking at very small effect sizes here. You're looking at population attributable risks, 2% at maximum. That's mostly that you see with a SNP. Mm-hmm. If you actually look at the standard areas in, let's say, smoking rates within these populations, and just to take one crude variable which we moderately well can actually characterize, and as we know, people do not... We often dichotomize that variable, where dichotomization is a gross simplification. Mm. How much do you actually think things like weight, blood pressure, glycemic variations, smoking and amount of cigarettes actually could be affecting these studies through mechanism that we actually... Because these studies are only done once or twice, we might quite easily miss it. There is no repeated validation in multiple populations. All you see is one large study, and if you have to find 100,000 people to actually do this, you've actually probably pulled virtually every single cohort that's available in this area to do it. And that means that doing a validation study is actually quite difficult, and multiple validation studies, which is what you need to actually possibly attach some of these confounding, is virtually impossible.
This goes back again to the design of the study. And if you select your genetic instrument such that it shouldn't be associated with environmental factors, so that we've got a GWAS of smoking behavior, and we know that there are genes that are associated with smoking behavior. And if you're happy that your selected variant is not related either through linkage disequilibrium with those variants, then it's unlikely that your variant is going to be confounded by smoking behavior. If you do see an association with smoking behavior, then your variant is doing something to smoking behavior, if you've designed your study right. So if you see that your variant affects inflammation and BMI, then the BMI is not a confounder. It's on your pathway because of the principles of the MR paradigm, reliant on adequate and appropriate study design.
One needs to be cautious about whether that assumption is valid.
I agree. The assumption appears to be a dangerous one. I think as we get more data from GWAS, we're able to triangulate potentially confounding other variants with the variant that we want to select to try and avoid this sort of confounding by linkage disequilibrium. But again, if we see effects downstream that we don't expect, and we've taken that sort of problem into account at the beginning, then it's reasonable to assume, all other things being correct, that those effects are a consequence of your genetic variant.
Yes, if I can just ask, you're looking for a difference between the genotypes.
Yeah.
And there are three possible explanations. One is chance, so that's where statistical analysis comes in. The other is it's a causal effect of the genotype itself. And the third is some sort of confounding. And you're saying we're reasonably confident that the confounding issue can be ruled out, but is reasonably confident good enough?
I think at the moment it has to be, but we have to make that caveat clear in the design. I think saying, well, this variant is doing this and that's all it's doing because we've excluded everything else is a little bit simplistic and possibly naive. I think we can do a lot with the data we have from sequencing, from LD structure, to try and avoid that sort of problem, but we can't rule it out completely. But we're getting a reasonable way to be able to do that.
I think that it would be wise if people using this technique stopped calling it randomization and used the word you have used, a genetic instrument, because that would remind people that this is just another statistical method and you have to be sure. When you're using the word randomization, it reminds everyone that randomization is the almost perfect way of avoiding even unknown confounding. And when you read the literature of people using this genetic instrument, it's quite often that they are very brief in talking about all the assumptions that they need. So a different word would help the field.
Yeah, to be fair to Dan, I think a lot of the early analyses that were done, I mean, maybe we haven't seen it in later analyses, they have looked at usual, so when they've studied coronary artery disease, they have included things like smoking, they have included blood pressure, they've included other measurements, and actually looking at the variant and the wild type alleles, they've really not shown a difference. It's something that needs to be shown for all studies going forward so you can be more certain that there isn't some confounding factors, but at least a lot of the early studies, in fact, actually did do that, to be fair. And the comment about gene-environment interactions, well, to be fair, if we're going to study gene-environment interactions, you don't need 100,000 people, you need over 1 million people. You know, and if basically your genes have such a small effect, gene-environment interactions at a population level are going to be negligible, absolutely irrelevant.
If I just come back on that one, in the epidemiology, we actually were talking earlier about dalcetrapib and torcetrapib, where we're looking at relatively small changes in blood pressure, 16,000 patients, 1.53 millimetres, and we're saying that that actually was significant difference. What kind of change would we necessarily see and have statistical power to actually look at a population attributable risk of 2%? Could easily be as small as 0.1, 0.2 millimetres. And given the variation, biological variation in the underlying parameter, that would come under our standard statistical testing, would come out as non-significant. But nevertheless, could actually be quite a powerful confounder in a study this large because the effect size is so small.
Who wants to comment on that?
I mean, you have a very small effect size of your principal phenotype, but then you've got an even tinier, approaching negligible effect of your gene-environment interaction. And I think gene-environment interactions aren't necessarily a problem if the environment is interacting with the gene that you think you're looking at. It's just it's part of your downstream consequence. You go from gene through to protein through to disease, and then you spring back off the environment, and that influences disease and biomarkers again. I think that's perfectly reasonable to bring into the study. It's very, very difficult to measure, but I think saying that it's a fatal flaw in the methodology is sort of denying the benefits.
So the title of this was Identify New Targets. Has this been used? Has any industry, any drug company actually begin to use genetic instrument?
It has been used for LPPLA2, but not this instrument. I mean, but the some of the data that basically has come out has been used for a couple of molecules where the decision on probably not to go through to drug development or at least get additional testing before they go through a large phase 3 trial, that actually has occurred.
So they're using it to stop, to make the stop.
Or to do further tests, not necessarily to stop the whole program, but basically to get additional data.
And I can just, further upon that, I think we use it as a tool. Like, I think we all appreciate, and, I think Dan's done a nice job of trying to defend the tool. But it is a tool, and that's what it is. And I think we recognize that there are limitations to it. But there are also possibly benefits. And then what we do is we look at the totality of the data that can include preclinical. Work like that, Professor Stahls is doing, but also the human genetic data as well.
So what's interesting at the moment, so if I go back, not so much for LPPL, the decision when GSK made the decision to go for Daraplidiv was largely based on a pooling project of the entirety of the world, serum measurements and plasma measurements of LPPLA2 mass and activity, showing a modest but independent association. Then those trials have started. So over 30,000 people will know in about 2 years' time what that's going to show with Daraplidiv. In the meantime, the group that Dan works in, they have basically looked at using this tool and seeing what the gene variants do with LPPLA2 mass activity and CHD outcomes, and there doesn't appear to be association. So if the drug trials, for example, then that come out and do not show a favorable effect on CHD, then I think you've got a good comparative. On the other hand, the drug shows a benefit and the Mendelian randomization data suggest a null effect, then you've got to question this, but we'll perhaps have that data in a few years' time.
And if we go back to the IL-6R example, if someone were minded to take tocilizumab in a similar way to the CANTOS trial is taking canakinumab and use that for prevention of coronary heart disease, then I think then we'd see the pathway go all the way through to, I guess, repurposing of a drug, which perhaps is the most useful application of this technique, where we have a molecule, we have a target that we know is safe, it's used in a different indication, but then a Mendelian randomization study helps to repurpose it for a different indication where it can show benefit.
Can we come back to the anti-inflammatory therapy a little bit later? I'd like to continue with what you said based on what we have seen so far with regard to 2-phospholipases. And you're correct, the genetic data. And obviously we did GVAS and then tried to see whether there's association between the hits we found with cardiovascular endpoints. And it was not really overwhelming what has been seen there. But in the context of what you're discussing here, there's another example, another phospholipase, where I'd like Bob to expand a little bit on that, where we have promising biomarker data. There is a Mendelian randomization in quote, which is negative. It has not been published so far, but it is negative. And as you all know, in March of this year, a phase 3 trial with the secretory phospholipase has been stopped prematurely because of not only futility, but also potential of harm. So what can we learn from this exercise? I mean, maybe you want a little bit expand on the background, and you're also familiar with the genetics of SPLA2.
secretory fossil lipase-A2 has multiple different isoforms. Four are involved in human atherosclerosis. And varesplatib is a pan-secretory PIL-A2 inhibitor. We know it reduces the 2A, 5, and 10 concentrations, although we couldn't establish a decrease in activity because this is a protein. When you inhibit it, it downregulates its own production, which, again, in a GWAS study, wouldn't be able to, tease this out. You would miss that signal. There are animal studies, knockouts, and gain-of-function studies that have clearly shown that the 2A, 5, and 10 are in the causal pathway for atherosclerosis. In the phase 2 trials that we conducted, there were favorable changes in LDL cholesterol, non-HDL cholesterol, ApoB, and reductions in CRP, at least in the Francis trial. So we thought that all the biomarkers were going in the correct direction. The phase 3 trial, however, was stopped early. And I think we have to be very careful in terms of the interpretation of that trial. The company that sponsored the trial, Anthera, had very little resources available. And they designed a study that was trying to go for an event reduction at 16 weeks on an atherosclerosis endpoint, when we know an atherosclerosis is a process that takes a much longer period of time. So they were banking on the effects of this compound on decreasing, in large part, complement binding to the ischemic myocardium and some of the injury that you can get there. Also, the tool was problematic. In that it's a water-soluble compound, an indole-based compound, and it may not have actually penetrated into the vessel wall to exert its effect, and maybe the reason why that compound has failed, not only in coronary disease patients, ulcerative colitis patients, rheumatoid arthritis patients, and lupus patients. So we have to be very careful about the interpretation of varesplatib studies with related to outcomes versus the pathway per se. And, I don't believe that they've actually genotyped the individuals to look at the distribution of the 5-10A, 2A, 5, 10, and 3 isoforms in the VISTA-16 trial to try and tease out some of these genetic associations. I know that's different than the work that's being done with LPPLA2, where they actually are genotyping the subjects in their phase 3 trial.
But I think that it's an interesting example where we really see differences in terms of the genetic information and compared to biomarkers. And then if we really go on for a phase 3 trial, we may be surprised. And it's difficult to integrate this information. And what are we doing if one of these is positive, the other one is negative? Does that influence our decision then? I mean, for new compounds, we have to do a phase 3 study anyway, but in terms of, let's say, what we're discussing in a broader sense here, stopping a development earlier based on negative outcomes in, let's say, in imaging or in biomarkers or in a genetic approach. So how do we really practically integrate these information, especially if it's controversial?
I guess the drug development pipeline has ways of prioritizing targets and molecules already, but I think adding the genetic data in adds another chunk of information to that decision-making process. I agree, it's risky, but the whole process is risky. But I think the basis on which we make the inference from Mendelian randomization studies makes the data from those less risky and possibly a more robust source of an indication of a target's utility earlier on. And you can do it very early on. I mean, you can do it before you've even thought what you were doing. You just wake up one morning and do an MR study.
Wolfgang, I think one of the things with at least the MR approach, it's if you think about the different stages, the first thing is, what are our potential targets? So this is identifying a potential target. Then you develop a drug. Then you've got a question mark over whether it is going to have an effect on the biomarkers or the disease process. So you're going to probably need imaging at that stage. We know, for example, things like ACAT inhibitors, that the drug development didn't go forward based on one IVUS trial. And then basically you're going to have to go and test. So the MR approach is not sort of saying, well, actually, we won't go to a phase three trial. It's identified. If I'm looking for new targets for drug development, then, you know, there's one use is this. The other thing is basically looking a genetic approach to, for example, a continuous trait, high and low LDL levels. There's a good example of that with PCSK9. Blood pressure, look at the extremes and look at the genetic determinants of that. And then that is a good tool to identify new drug targets. You then have to develop the safety and the efficacy, do the phase one, phase two trials. But then you've still got a problem in your phase three trials. You count the bodies. If you get the population wrong, because it may be that you're just picking a population with too much disease, or where the events are driven by something your drug does not modify, and that's incumbent on all of us in trial design. We've seen this in the renal arena, heart failure, and other areas as well. Then, you know, we can shut down the program, but it might be relevant for another disease area.
That's also an important point I want to come back in a few seconds, targeting the appropriate population. And I think we missed that in our discussion this morning on CDP inhibition. But coming back to the example to the alpha-pillar-2 you mentioned, I mean, there's some nice animal experiments. Also, there's still controversial data even on that level. If it comes to biomarker study in humans, there was no effect. If it comes to imaging, there was a questionable study. You may interpret it positive if you look at the key secondary endpoint, but the primary endpoint was missed. And then still the two large phase three trials have been initiated, and the first one at least will be carried out until the end because the second interim analysis was positive. So a lot of fairly weak, I would say, information before phase three trial, and to some extent also controversial if it comes to animal experiments, and still it has been going on now for 3.5 years, and so far it will be finished by early next year.
Along the genetic lines, you know, where is the data in terms of the loss of function? It's in Chinese Han and, you know, two flawed Korean studies where there were, you know, some baseline differences there. But in the Europoids, you know, there haven't been those associations with the loss of function mutations. And maybe they weren't as dramatic. So you've got inconsistent genetic data. And even though everybody talks about the favorable effects of Walensky's study with daraplatib, there are other studies in the animal models that show that higher LPPLA2 is associated with less atherosclerosis. Less atherosclerosis, not more atherosclerosis, and the animal data is inconsistent. So, I mean, how do you deal with these, you know, polymorphisms in the different populations and then kind of use that as your basis for going forward into these two large, outcome studies?
Bob, that's directly to what you said. Part of the discrepancies in animal experiments may be due to the model that you used, and we know that in rodents, for example, most of the alpha-pillar-2 travels with the HDL and not the LDL. So there may be differences between the pig model and the rodent model and certainly humans.
And I think with the genetic data, Bob, it was actually gain of function and higher LPPLA2 levels rather than loss of function and lower LPPLA2 levels, which basically that particular loss of function is most common in Southeast Asian populations. So there's obviously some question marks at the moment about safety with bowel cancers, for example, and you can't really use you can't really use the Chinese data particularly well because there aren't going to be many individuals with loss of function mutations.
Why don't we take it a stage further? If we're going to do Mendelian instrumentation studies, let's call it something else, should we actually design our trials by pre-selecting people with a certain genotype? Because these are common variants. We've already opened the door to these in some ways with one of the statin studies where we added a biomarker, in this case an inflammatory biomarker, CRP, to deal with the so-called pleiotropic assets of statins. Should we, in our phase three studies, actually base it saying, because this says more effect and we're more likely to see a difference, i.e. cut down our trial size, should we actually be pre-selecting people on genotype for these trials?
I think we need to learn a heck of a lot more about the influence of genotype on treatment response before we go anywhere near that. I think the data we have at the moment for pharmacogenetics is still very, very patchy, and the methodology needs to really be nailed with sufficiently powered, appropriately designed trials to then to tell us which variants to be typing before we start thinking about using those variants to be pre-selecting individuals to bump up a study's power and reduce its size.
Maybe not only pre-selecting on the basis of the genotype, but also on the basis of biomarkers. I mean, let's assume if the CDP inhibitor trial would have been positive, and you would, based on this, you would have seen an indication post-ACS or in chronic coronary disease to give a CDP inhibitor. And at the same time, let's assume that the alpha-beta-2 inhibition will have a positive outcome. So how are you going to select your patients? Because obviously you have not identified these patients on the basis of very low HDL, at least not in the CDP inhibitor trials. I think the only one was the VA hit that looked into low HDL. And also in case of the alpha-beta-2 inhibitor studies, it was chronic coronary heart disease or post-ACS. So the alpha-beta-2 level mass or activity did not play a role in selecting.
Although, having said that, though, it's been mandated that in the countries in Southeast Asia, when we are including those patients, mass and activity is being measured because those people with little or no mass or activity are not being randomized.
Yeah, but you use that for simply for exclusion a minority.
Absolutely,
but
excluding a minority. No, I agree. Yeah,
the majority.
Yeah.
So, if I may, I'm Nancy Geller. I'm standing right in front right now. You can't see because of the glare. I understand that. I think it's on. It wasn't close enough. In cancer, they do this. They use genotype to select a population for a trial. You can do this by beginning in everybody and then saying, I want to continue this trial in a certain genotype. It's a subgroup. It's an adaptive design. So one of the things that happens when you do this is you don't know if the treatment works in the other population, the one you left behind. And that's a downside. And if you really think there's this causal relationship, you really should be testing interaction between the gene and treatment. And that takes a very large sample size. So this technique of selecting subpopulations using genotype is in use in cancer. And generally, there's a bad story about one time selecting the subpopulation, and then lo and behold, the treatment didn't work in the subpopulation, nor did it work in the other population. And there's also the reverse, where it worked in the subpopulation and also worked in the subpopulation left behind once they tested that. So it's something you can do. The wisdom of it is questionable, especially if you don't really have a lot of evidence that the genotype is related to the treatment effect.
Just coming back on the cancer line, the one a good example I can think of is the BRAF inhibition pathway and the recent publications in melanoma on verafimib, where you have a specific BRAF inhibitor and you're looking at late stage melanoma, sort of where it's a drug desert, and absolutely nothing works. And there you have good validation on a pathway target, you have good validation on a genotype, and then you actually give a drug. Now, part of what I was hinting at was that with these agents, where we have a target, we have a drug with a big effect on a specific target, does this make sense? Because the oncologists have already, as you say, oncologists have already gone down this route. We have the BRAF drugs, and they're just the most obvious example that I can think of. There are other agents that work different ways in which you don't target that way. But it's a very seductive approach, and you can get the trial numbers down very, very fast, and you can increase the so-called risks very, very obviously to get an outcome.
Could I just make a remark down here? Stuart, again. Selecting on genotype before you go into the phase 3 is just another form of subgroup analysis, with all the traumas we have about subgroup selection before you go into a trial. The other reason why it might not appeal to a sponsor is it's narrowing their target indication at the end of the day once you've done the phase 3, because it then only relates to this genotype. So I suppose you're juggling with it. If it only works in the genotype, this drug, then that's where you need to go to be successful. But if there was, it's not only in the genotype, there's a broader effect, then you're missing a bigger target population at the end of the day. So I think it's back to your point, it's a very difficult tactic, strategic decision is being made.
I think it's dangerous, as you say, on the level of excluding a bunch of people before you go into a trial. It's all, you also exclude the possibility that your genotype upon which you base your decision to include or exclude may have an influence on disease risk itself. So you might be biasing your trial one way or the other by excluding the people with the opposite genotype. So there's two questions. Does the genotype affect disease and does it affect treatment response? So the most robust way, it appears, to do these trials is to have randomization to treatment or control and then genotype them to and saying, do you have this allele or that allele? So you always have a sort of a factorial design. And then you have everybody, but you hope to get your genotype, your genetic answer at the same time.
So you have an inbuilt interaction test at the end of the day,
yeah.
Heterogeneity test. Whatever.
But then you have to power for that as well,
yeah. Yes,
which indeed inflates the study size rather than the intended reduction.
I want to take this situation to come back to one of the limitations that you mentioned during your presentation, and this is certainly a basic question if it comes to what we're talking about, selecting new targets, whether or not the target is really druggable, let me put it this way. And you nicely illustrated the data that are around for IL-6, and I think it was very consistent back-to-back publication in Lancet this year. However, if I think about cytokines, I mean, that it's such a complex network, and some of them, and in particular, IL-6 has so many pleiotropic effects in terms of differentiation, maturation of cells. So I would be very skeptical to apply an inhibitor long-term to really be beneficial and not come up with some side effects.
It's a big worry, and if you modulate a system as complex as the IL-6 system, then it is a concern, and the big adverse effects reported in the trials in patients with rheumatoid are the risk of infection, sort of serious respiratory infections, skin infections, and also the lipid changes, but that's sort of an almost separate question. But modulating such an important immune pathway is risky, but we're seeing it happen now with the CANTOS trial modulating IL-1 receptor, and even with methotrexate. So there's this blanket bombing of inflammation. Not quite sure where that's going to go, but it'll be interesting to see.
I think you're right, but just because of these concerns of increased infection, for the CANTOS study, it was IL-1 beta antibody was selected, because based on long-standing research, it certainly plays an important role in the inflammation cascade, but it does not seem to be the crucial cytokine for the host defense. But despite of that, I mean, there are a lot of precautions taken in the trial to exclude latent tuberculosis, to do QuantiFERON tests, for example, and also other chronic diseases. So, but still, there is a chance for increased infections during this intervention. But on the other hand, I mean, I think it's a nice discussion, because it's a different target, which also brings up the point that we need different tools according to the type of the target. So in that instance, for example, evaluating the effect, I think brings me back to the imaging, and in particular to inflammation, measuring inflammation by PET CT or whatever it is, that could help us in better understand what this particular drug is doing, because you would expect a decrease in inflammatory signals when you do imaging in these patients. Would you briefly comment on that?
Especially in the case of Actemra, for example, where you're looking at the LDL changes and you want to balance the effects of the anti-inflammatory approach versus some of the potentially negative effects induced by raising the LDL. So I agree completely that imaging might.
So sorry, this is one of the advantages of IL-1 beta antibody, because it does not increase, in contrast to inhibition of TNF alpha and IL-6, it does not increase the LDL.
Correct. And going back for just a moment with regards to the IL-6 approach, one thing that we didn't really discuss is the context within which we actually study the genetic changes. When we talk about the chronic exposure from genetic changes, we're not really anticipating changes due to heightened inflammation, as you see with RA. So if you extrapolate from the studies that were just presented to what you might see in patients who are treated with Actemra with an RA, you might not really see some of the elevations in LDL, and you might not see, therefore, some of the deleterious effects. So I wouldn't want to extrapolate from these genetic studies what a drug intervention would do. We need to be very cautious. There was a statement that was made earlier that if there's a disconnect, for example, the LPPLA2 studies versus what we're seeing with the genetic studies, that we might be less interested in the genetic studies down the road. I wouldn't want to do that. I would say that, as you've been very careful to state, it's really just an early insight, and we shouldn't extrapolate too much in terms of the treatment of results at the end.
Okay. Anyone wants to comment on that?
I agree. These Mendelian randomization studies are generally done in healthy populations who almost certainly wouldn't be having treatment for severe rheumatoid arthritis, are less likely to be having cardiovascular risk reduction interventions. So we need to be, as you say, careful about how we interpret these data, but nonetheless, they're big, robust data from hopefully well-designed studies that carry some weight.
So I would, going back a little bit to Nancy's comment, the public and our patients want personalized medicine. They want to know that the treatment they're going to take is actually going to work for them. So while I'm not sure that I would do initial clinical trials based on genotype, genotyping people who are in clinical trials to see if you can get a signal to do further studies down the road could be very beneficial in the long run. But it is, I can see, a risk for industry because it could definitely change your indication.
Let me just comment from an industry perspective. And so when I left from academics and went into industry, I can no longer say these things, so I'm going to ask you to say them for me. But we actually have a really hard time being able to get consent from patients and IRBs, ethics committees, regulatory bodies, to do genetic testing or any type of genomic analyses on patients because there's this... and it's legitimate, these concerns over Big Brother and all these issues of, you know, we're going to change people's insurance, et cetera, based on their genetic data. But we have a very hard time, particularly certain countries, of getting that type of data. I think we're actually quite interested in it because, I think we realize that there are therapies that need to be tailored for individual patients. And we all have this, we like to talk about personalized medicine. We're not there yet, obviously, but I think that if we can develop medications that are safe and well tolerated and directed towards certain patients, then that's what we should be doing.
So I think that's interesting because we, in our large population studies, actually do a pretty good job of getting people to consent for doing DNA. But it is true there is some. In one of the studies we did, we had a tiered consent. Anybody can use my DNA. NIH-funded investigators can use my DNA. Only Accord investigators. And there was definitely a tail off. There were people trusted their PIs but didn't necessarily trust the world to use their DNA. So it wasn't a huge, but there was some drop off in that. So I'm sympathetic to your point.
So now imagine if you're a drug company, what they're going to think.
I think one of the things we haven't talked about, if you are going to talk about personalized medicine, is absolute risk. So, we apply these trials to our the trials tell you about populations and perhaps what you should do for a strategy. If you're a patient, you kind of want to know, well, if I take the statin or the blood pressure lowering agent, how much in absolute terms is this going to benefit me? And part of what we should actually going back to, what we should really try and go back to, and there's a number of people doing a lot of work around this, is actually from the trial data, look at the absolute event rates and the characteristics, because it's going to be composites of lots and lots of different factors. and to try and give you, if you like, the profile of those people that will gain the greatest absolute event reduction. So we can actually tell our patients that. If you want to move to personalized medicine, even before the genetics, doing the simple things well from the trials will give you a lot more information.
I think that's certainly a very important point, and I think in some of the trials that are currently being run, we're realizing that the event rates that we're seeing are even lower than what we have been expected from registries. So even in the post myocardial infarction phase, it's probably less than 4% per year.
I mean, absolutely. And you know, we've had this with diabetes. Event rates for diabetes are not 2% a year. Contemporary, I mean, it's more like 1.2% a year. So unless you've got microalbuminuria, renal disease, or if you've had, you know, diabetes for 16 years, systolic over, you know, 180, HbA1c over 10. So we kind of need to basically, because we are talking about individuals and giving them lifelong therapy, and the patients deserve to know what in absolute terms for them is their absolute benefit versus their, you know, we're not in the business necessarily of either overestimating or underestimating, merely quantifying as best as we can and translating that to our patients and having a discussion with our patients with their consent to best inform them.
I certainly fully agree, but if you had a comment? Rita?
Sure. I mean, I agree. I think what Dr. Bond said, it's very important to our patients to know, is the therapy going to help them? I guess what is less clear to me is how genetics will actually, well, whether that will accomplish that goal, because except for a very few examples, it seems, I mean, for all the reasons that you've been discussing, and, you know, I think of the FDA labeling on the platelets, genetics for warfarin, which didn't seem clinically to be very relevant, unfortunately, although, you know, and so that's what, it's such a tricky field already, and so I think the goal is correct, but I'm just not really convinced at this time that we can really promise that, and it does seem to be that's what's being promised to patients now on the basis of genetic testing.
And I think that's a great point, but there are many believers out there that you will be genotyped at birth, and that will dictate your treatments for life.
That's what scares me.
I think the other thing, though, you know, is that we need to recognize that, you know, similar to our discussions yesterday around imaging, that if we don't keep on doing research in this area, we won't get to that stage. And so if patients aren't willing to work with us and work with academics to be able to provide the samples to do the experiments to get to the stage, we're never going to get there.
I agree with you, absolutely. I just think I have seen very few examples when we talk about a research tool when it doesn't very quickly become a clinical or commercial tool. It's direct to consumer advertised, at least in the United States, to do genetic testing. I can send in, you know, for $1,000 and get genotypes and be told what kind of diseases I'm going to get. And I mean, that's true for a number of other
but
things
still,
that we say are research tools, but they very quickly, like the next, we're not talking about it now, with beta amyloid testing, which is supposed to be a research tool, but is also being touted clinically.
Yeah, I think there are certain companies that are going beyond the goals, but still guidelines, I think, are very, very cautious and mostly negative in terms of genetic testing, because I think it is certainly justified at this stage.
I think really there's also the issue, I know with statins there was a huge story in the US, particularly around KIF6 testing, around statin efficacy for a drug group that we have well established. And we only need to look at the meta-analysis by the Oxford group to sort of see that we have to sort of, those of us who actually also run diagnostic laboratories as well as being involved in treatment data, so we have to be very, very careful about some of these tests and how they are validated and whether they are approved or not, because I think that our licensing system for drugs is incredibly strict and very, very evidence-based. Our licensing systems for diagnostics are anything but, I'm afraid.
Yeah, Tapasong?
Yeah, I just wanted to comment about what you said about genotyping regarding antiplatelet or warfarin. Just to say that we were one of the teams who did the job on clopidogrel and looking to the genetics who were involved in the drug response. But very surprised of the labeling of the FDA so quickly, which because you do the research and then you have to you validate a factor that may be associated to a risk. That doesn't mean necessarily that if you do something about it, you can change the effects. That's my first point. The second is that there is still, and we don't have the time here to discuss about it, but there is still a risk with, for example, for the CYP, with 2C19 or whatever, with clopidogrel, in some population which are at high risk, and those in which clopidogrel has actually the most effect, and in those population, the genotype adds an additive value in terms of clinical outcome. And this is not true, for example, in AF population in which clopidogrel has a very, very low effect. So what I'm saying is that the research in the genetic response on a drug should be done and should be followed, because they are some additive value. But we need to do trials when we detect, just like the other research tools that we use, we should test the validity of using the genetic or the SNP variant as a tool to identify patients at high risk and show the effects. And that's what is being done at the moment for warfarin, for example. So we have to wait before having a guidelines and recommendation in terms of clinical practice.
Could we not just include in the trial design, and Stuart Pocock sitting in the audience, of if you have enough information on the biology? I mean, the problem with a lot of these things is you've done the trial, and then retrospectively you've got some data, so you go back into the data set. But if you knew a priori before that there is some good biology, you could actually have the interaction basically in there. Because, I mean, the problem is if you don't have an interaction, this becomes looking at like a group like diabetes and non-diabetes in a subgroup. You've got a higher absolute event rate, so the event rate, the effect in absolute terms looks bigger in that patient population. But what you're really interested in is effect modification, no effect or very little effect versus a significantly greater effect, you know, prasugrel versus clopidogrel with the CYP2C19. So if you know that a priori, and, I mean, you've got to do your sample size calculations appropriately, but that there isn't any reason why that can't be factored into the trial, surely.
Can we have a microphone for Stuart?
Have you already implied you've got a problem with patient numbers in the trial? So if you strongly plan that that's the primary interaction of interest, then and that was the interaction you always knew you wanted to look at, then that makes it a bit better than your average subgroup analysis interaction claim after doing a trial. If this is a regulatory phase 3 trial, how's the regulator going to react to that site of what still looks a bit like a post hoc claim? And of course the patient numbers go up. So it's got its problems, even though... But another point you made yourself, Dr. Ray, was about personalized medicine in terms of absolute benefits could be much more focused on other issues that have nothing to do with genotype indications. To remember all the risk factors that, in addition, affect the absolute benefit of a treatment. So there's a danger of getting carried away on genotype issues when there's so much more boring stuff, to put it that way, that we know already we don't use properly, which is younger patients on a statin, the absolute benefit is rather small. We use that when it comes to cost effectiveness, but we don't use it in our usual interpretation of a trial.
And taking that point to a very large extent, the boring stuff is just reflected by the genetics anyway. I mean, apart from age and sex, a lot of the things we measure for standard risk stratification is determined by the genetics. So we measure the same thing twice, it adds very little.
Oh, I'm not sure it's as simple as that. I mean, in heart failure, for instance, you would have a recent history of heart failure. Hospitalizations raises the risk, which NYHA class you're in, your ejection fraction. I don't think those are directly linked to genotype. So there's many more risk factors than you might think.
Oh, no, I agree. I mean, adding genetics adds not very much, is what I was trying to say.
Potentially, always adding one more risk factor, no matter how exciting it is, adds relatively little to predictive power alongside all the other risk factors you already know about. Yes, I think that's true of anything. No matter how scientifically, biologically exciting it might be, the payoff in absolute benefit might be small.
Okay. Question for Stuart and Tony, if I may. I mean, why don't we, you know, I mean, Tony, you're chairing a committee basically that's looking at health economics, a number of other issues. We have all this stuff on relative risk reductions, and that's fine. But at the end of the day, you know, we treat individuals, and it's about the absolute risk in these individuals. So why don't we actually get more information that will actually help us to personalize, rather than saying, well, you know, at a population level, but you may be very different from the average in the population. Why don't we do that? Why don't we generate that data from the clinical trials?
Well, from a guidelines perspective, it's very similar, because guidelines are written for the majority of people, and therefore they're written for the average plus or minus two standard deviations, whatever that is in any area. So with guideline committees, you end up having to pretty much come to a lowest common denominator that people will accept, and that is, most of all, safe. Because safety is absolutely critical in guidelines. You do not want to recommend a strategy that will go to a national population, be implemented by people with relatively limited knowledge of the compounds, the biology, and we'll look at this thing. You have got to be safe. So guidelines committees will always tend to err, like regulatory committees, very much towards the trend of safety. Secondly, because guidelines are built around the average person, inverted commas, then they will always exclude, by definition, the people at the extreme ends of the distribution. Now, the low-risk people we don't tend to worry about, but they also tend to very much more exclude the high-risk people, who actually form a relatively small proportion, because you cannot actually make recommendations about that. Often there's no evidence. What evidence there is very limited. And essentially, it makes a minor contribution to the health economic quality gain in any case when you actually run all the modelling that it's all based on. So I'm afraid guidelines committees can't be very, very helpful there.
Tony, can I ask a question? I'd like to, in our quest towards personalised medicine, I ask as a clinician rather than as an imager, to what extent are we disabled by our focus on traditional classifications of risk, by which I mean we focus on diabetes, which is diagnosed by blood sugar elevation and its biochemical consequences, hyperlipidemia, because at a certain phase in biochemical history, people were able to centrifuge plasma and measure cholesterol levels. Blood pressure, why? Because we could measure blood pressure easily and conveniently. But in terms of the diseases we're interested in and the outcomes for patients, these are largely irrelevant, or if not irrelevant, maybe overstating it, but they are arbitrary measures. They don't relate to the disease itself, merely to things that we could once measure. And we focus ever more and more effort, be it in physiology or genetics or whatever, in trying to understand how very complex things influence these very simple things, which I would suggest to you are rather superficial. And if we really want to approach personalized medicine, we have to understand much more about the disease process rather than simply using labels of convenience which suit our medical purposes.
I totally agree. I would be the first one who would stand up and say, if we could diagnose atherosclerosis cheaply, simply, non-invasively, and safely,
That's what we would do. Every single guidelines committee in the world would basically back that approach. The problem with atherosclerosis is it's like dementia. It's often a post-mortem diagnosis. And therefore, we get pushed back to various forms of surrogacy, whether we like it or not. So we go back one step. You can actually say, well, the imaging is the first level surrogate, because that's often a good guy. But the imaging is not either reliable, cheap enough, available enough, or whatever. So we have to get pushed back a bit further to the epidemiology, where we came up with a whole lot of markers that are very easy and cheap to measure: blood pressure, cholesterol, number of cigarettes smoked. And we use those, and we actually calculate risks and say, well, this is what's going to happen. Well, it's not true. If you look at the risk studies that have been done for populations where they have done a Framingham risk assessment, or the British investigators did it with the QRIS tool, which is a UK-specific tool, and looked at the people who had events, the overlap wasn't that great. It was actually under 50% of events were correctly predicted. So our current tools, though we may use them, and they're the best we've got, are very, very flawed. Please come up with a better one.
Okay, I think we certainly could continue with this discussion, with this very interesting discussion, but I guess for the sake of time, we have to come to our final topic, which is LDL, and I'd like to hand over to you.
Thank you very much. We've looked at already a particle we don't understand, to a series of interventions which we're unsure about. Now let's turn to something we're certain about. We're certain about LDL, are we? And I'd like to ask my co-chair, Wolfgang Koenig, to actually introduce the subject of identifying new targets and monoclonal antibody inhibition of PCSK9, a novel regulator of the LDL pathway.